Prabhupati Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We were introduced to the Spotavad, the simpler idea of how statements are understood is that even though the sounds of the pronunciation of the phonemes, I say that because at least in the Mimamsa and Vedanta schools, it's assumed that the aksharas are eternal. Because we're talking, first of all, about Vedic sound, Vedic language. And the Vedic language is eternal. So the actual sounds of the Vedas are eternal, but we pronounce the Vedas, they come out of our mouth, and those sounds that come out of our mouth are not eternal. And how we understand the statements of the Vedas or any other statements has to involve hearing the sounds. We're ordinary human beings. We receive Shabda Praman through our ears or eyes if we're reading print on paper. We have to receive the Shabda through our senses. And so it is dependent on some sort of sensory perception. Our perception of the individual sounds, which is what we basically hear, we hear this sound and then followed by the next sound, bhagavan, we hear three syllables. If I said wangabug backwards, it wouldn't mean the same thing. I hear those particular sounds in a certain order, those aksharas. Now the practical problem is, sounds themselves go out of existence almost immediately. They're not there to look at after the sound has been pronounced. Of course, if you have it on paper, it may be a different situation. But if you're listening, the actual sound doesn't persist, not very long. So what is it you perceive when you've reached the end of the sentence? How do you perceive it? So the simpler theory, the first theory presented, is that simply there is a mental impression created by each sound, and that remains in the mind. Samskara, when you perceive something or experience an emotion or experience something through the senses or think something, the mind, that perception, that feeling, that thought goes away, it goes out of existence, but there's something left in the mind, an impression, a residue. You know, there's something stored in the mind as a reaction to that sensation or perception or feeling. That's called samskara. That's the meaning, one basic meaning of the word samskara. Impressions left in the mind by experiences in the mind. Thoughts, feelings, and sensations. So the idea is, even though the sounds are gone, they've left behind their impressions. And so when you hear this last sound, and the sentence is finished, then you go back, and all these impressions left in your mind somehow get together and produce the meaning of the sentence. Well, the Spotavadis are not satisfied with this. And the reason is, the remembrance produced by mental impressions. The impression is something stored in your brain or mind. And then when you recollect it, it brings back a memory of something. The impression creates a memory. A memory is an experience in the present of something you perceived in the past. That's a memory. Something happened in the past and you perceived it in the past, but now you are remembering it. That means in the mind, you're thinking about it. You're seeing an image or thinking a thought. That's a remembrance produced by a mental impression, by a samskara. The thing that happened in the past can't be producing the memory because it's not there anymore. But the impression that was left in the mind, that's creating the memory. So the Spotavadis, they say, well, this first theory doesn't work right because even those memories come one after another. You may remember them in a different order. You know, you don't have to remember things in the same order they're stored in your brain. When you're daydreaming or sleeping, the daydreams and sleep don't come in chronological order, in the order that you perceived everything in your life. It comes in random order. You just, you know, something pops up in your head when you're daydreaming or sleeping. It's not necessarily the very next thing after the last thing you thought about. Not in sequential order. It can be random order. But it is that you only have one remembrance at a time. Because otherwise it'd be confused. You just, you know, remember 10 different things at once. It's just confusion. So you deal with one remembering normally, one remembrance at a time. Maybe you could dump two on top of each other, and you get a combined remembrance. You once saw a big mountain, and you once saw a pile of gold, and then in a dream you see a golden mountain. So you're combining two remembrances into one, two samskaras into one memory in a dream. But there's a limit to that. You can't just put all the memories together. You just get a mush. You just get a total confusion if you try to remember everything at once. The mind doesn't do that anyway. It doesn't have the power to remember many things at once. Maybe two things at once or three. But beyond that, it's beyond the power of the mind to combine so many memories. And if you did, it would just be a total confusion. So the normal procedure is you remember one thing at a time. Even if it's not in the original order, but it's one thing at a time. But that creates a problem. How do you perceive the meaning of the whole sentence all at once? If all you're doing is perceiving the impressions left by the sounds one after another, whether it's in the right order, I guess when you're hearing sentences, to properly understand what something in language means, you're supposed to remember it in the same order. If I've got something, you know, some wires twisted in my brain, something wrong in part of my brain, and when I remember, you say a sentence, and I remember it 5 seconds later backwards or in random order, then my ability to understand language is severely impaired. People, there are some people like that. You know, their power to understand language is mixed up. The wires are crossed. So normally, when you're remembering what someone said to you, you remember the sounds in the same order. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Not as language communication. The brain is set up to remember those things in the same order. Although when you're dreaming, you remember things in random order. When you're daydreaming, things just pop up. But when you're involved in trying to understand what people are saying, you got to remember what they're saying in the same order. Otherwise, it gets confused. Okay, but that's a problem. You're remembering one thing and then the next thing, one sound, the second sound, the third sound, the fourth sound. Those memories, one after another, they're not all at the same time. How are you going to grasp the meaning of the whole sentence all at one time? The Spotavadis say that this way of doing it doesn't work. It doesn't produce a final... even the last sound of the sentence is not going to make you understand the whole sentence. So they say there's a special power that does this for you. It's not the power of the individual sounds to make up words, or of the individual words to convey separate meanings. It's another power that's in the sentence, in the whole sentence, called spota. And that spota will reveal itself to you when you've heard the whole sentence and the impressions have been laid in your brain, and then the spota comes out and turns on a light in your head, and you understand what the sentence means. That's spotavad, basically. But it's on two levels. There's a shabda spota, where having heard all the letters in the word lead you to a recognition of the word and what it means. And then when the sentence is finished, you put all the words together, all the words have been said, and you've recognized them by shabda spota. Then the vakya spota gives you a sudden revelation of the meaning of the whole sentence. Not by combination or remembrance, but just by a special energy. Something goes off. You know, a little explosion in your head. And you recognize what the sentence means. That's spotavad. Okay, that was just a recapitulation. Now we move ahead. Okay, ask a question, but I don't want to get anywhere off track. Go ahead, one question.
Can we say that the spota is like the super soul, making you understand?
They don't say that. They don't say that. They don't bring that. The super soul into it.
It's like...
It's a power in the sentence.
It's like the scientists, they talk about instinct. And then Prabhupada...
Yeah, but... Which scientists? Okay, biologists talk about instinct.
Yeah, instinct in animals is instinct. Then Prabhupada explains, "Oh, this is a way of explaining it without God. They're putting God out of the picture. That's why they put speaking about instinct, but actually it's a super soul. So, are they doing something similar?
They're putting the super soul out of the picture.
Out of the picture and coming.
They're not dealing with the super soul, but they are dealing with what they think is the absolute truth. But their idea is the sound itself is the absolute truth. So the sound, the absolute truth in the form of the sound, especially the sound of the Vedas, that's what's producing the spota. The spota is an expression of the sound, and the sound is the absolute truth. Supersoul is just some superimposition. The idea of supersoul or of God is just a very subtle illusion, but the reality is the sound.
So it's the sound is the source of the spota, and yes. The sentence is also the source of the spota. Like there's the
sabda
spota and the vakya spota.
You're using sound in the singular. I was talking about the individual aksharas, the sounds. When I say sound singular, I mean the entire sound of the Vedas, the Vedic language. Okay? There's a difference between sound singular and sound plural. The sounds plural, the little letters that make up a word, there is a recognition of the word by shabda spota. And when the words make up the sentence, there's a recognition of the sentence by vakya spota. Okay?
And this comes somewhere from the mind? It's the, I guess.
It comes from the sound itself, from the sentence.
Thank you.
The sentence is the absolute truth, and it reveals itself in the mind. The mind receives the recognition of the spota. Okay, let's go to the next paragraph. Ata eva spota rupatvad vedasya nityatvam. Tasya pratyucharanam pratyabhigyayamanatvat. Vedantinas tu varna eva tu shabda iti bhagavan upavarshaha. Iti tam nyayam anusvitya dvir go shabda yam ucharita natu dva go shabdav iti ekataiva sarvai pratyabhigyayamanatvat. Varnatmakanam eva shabdanam nityatvam. This goes on, there's a long sentence. Angikritya teja varna pipilika pamptivat pramadyanugrahitartha vishesha sambadda santa svavyavahare pi ekaika varna grahananantaram samasta varna pratyaya darshinyam buddhau tadrisham eva pratyavavasamanas. tam tam artam avyabhicharena pratyayishyanti ityato varnavadinam lagyasi kalpanasyat. Translation of that. It's one big sentence, but actually I've split the translation into a few sentences. Therefore, say the followers of Bhartrahari, the Vedas are eternal because they take the form of Spota. Spota is the Veda. Veda is the Spota. And that Spota Veda is eternal. And there's a statement from, let's see, who is this? I'm sorry, I have to see the footnotes to tell you who said it. 645. Damn, damn, damn. Krishna. Shankaracharya, in his Shirdika Bhasha and Vedanta Sutra 1328, is saying this and a few other things. I think there are three different quotes here from the same place in Shankaracharya. So Shankaracharya says, indeed, the repeated utterance is an act of recollection. What does that mean? If I say, look at the cow, and I, again, tomorrow say, look at the cow, are those two separate sentences? The idea of the Spotavadi is no. The Spota, the sentence, Spota is the power of the meaning of the sentence, is eternal. So I haven't said two different sentences. I've said the same sentence twice. I remember the same idea. I'm not creating a new idea. So the repeated utterance is an act of recollection. You're remembering the same utterance, the same sentence. Yes? We're talking, first of all, about the Vedas, but this can apply to all language. It's a general state. It's general enough it can apply to any language. The proponents, because ordinary language may use different words and different grammar, but it basically uses the same aksharas or similar aksharas. And aksharas are eternal. The components of language are eternal, and even if you make a new language, it's basically made from the same components. You just mix things up. You know, you take, instead of taru, those two phonemes, you use two other phonemes, or one other phoneme, baum, I guess that's three phonemes. Baum, in German, means tree. So you use different phonemes to express the same idea. But that ba-au-m also exists in Vedic Sanskrit. The phonemes aren't different. You're just mixing them up, using different ones for different words. So the phonemes are eternal. So the language, the spota is eternal, even in a foreign language. Yes, Prabhu, I wanted to go through this without going off on tangents. Is it? Can we wait? Yes? No, let's wait for that. This is a side discussion. Let's follow what's being said here. Otherwise, if we stop after every sentence, then we'll get lost. Let me read the sentence again. Therefore, say the followers of Bhartrahari, the Vedas are eternal because they take the form of Spota. Indeed, the repeated utterance is an act of recollection. And it's Shankaracharya who said that in his Sharirika Bhasha. The proponents of Vedanta philosophy, however, follow this principle. The phonemes themselves are the verbal expression, according to Bhagavan Upavarsha. So we say the phonemes, the Vedantists and the Mimamsakas say it's the phonemes that are eternal, and they themselves make up the sentences. We don't need any spota here in our theory. Okay? They say the spota is the actual sentence. We say the phonemes make up the sentence, the aksharas. And we do say that on the authority of the venerable sage Upavarsha. That's also Shankaracharya quoting or stating this. The Vedantists thus acknowledge that words, simply as composed of phonemes, are eternal. Since everyone realizes the sameness of the sounds referred to, when one says the word go, cow, has been produced twice, you don't say two different words, go, have been pronounced. You say it, you consider it the same word, but said twice. Not that there's two different words, one go and a different go. The word is eternal, because it's made of eternal aksharas. And in the Vedas, even the words are eternal. Even all the sentences, even the whole book is eternal. In non-shruti, in non-eternal scripture, in smriti, and in ordinary language, the eternal phonemes are there, but what you make out of them is not eternal. Okay, continuing. These phonemes, now here's the Vedanta way of explaining how the phonemes give us the meaning, without resorting to a separate energy called spota. These phonemes, moreover, become bound like ants in a row. This is a metaphor. It's like ants are walking in a row. They're all following the same instinct, to go after a piece of sugar. And they're walking in a row. Similarly, the phonemes are walking along in a row in a sentence. Are bound to particular meanings, endowed with sequence and other features. And when they are employed in being spoken, bound by to sequence, because you can't just say the same phonemes in a reverse order or mixed up order, it doesn't mean the same thing if you change the order of the phonemes. They have to be bound to sequence, and other things have to be fixed also, other features. And when they are employed, the phonemes, in being spoken, because what you do with your mouth is produce different phonemes. You can program a computer. All you have to do is give it all the phonemes and teach it how to properly pronounce phonemes in sequence. Proper sequence, proper intonation, then the computer can imitate speech. All the computer needs is the phonemes. The phonemes are employed in being spoken. And then the perception of one phoneme after another is followed by the phonemes. Okay, now I changed this translation, but I don't have my computer with me. I'll have to guess, try to remember what the change was. This reflecting is confusing. Someone complained about it. So I changed reflecting because it's not a mirror. It was a little too poetic. So I said the phonemes are remembered again in an awareness in which the perception of all the phonemes together, the perception of all the phonemes together is displayed. Main thing I'm doing here is changing reflecting to remembering. That's what kind of reflecting it is. It's reflecting in the sense of remembering. So I just use the word remembering. Just take the word reflecting and change it to remembering. Remembered. Being remembered instead of reflecting. So I'll read it again, although I did change a few other words, but that's not so important. I'll just read this with that one change. The perception of one phoneme after another is followed by the phonemes being remembered again in an awareness that displays perception of all the phonemes together. So you do actually have in your mind some image of all the phonemes together, according to the Vedantists. Because the phonemes are not, they may go away, but they're attached to the meanings. And so remembrance of them is still available. You can remember all the phonemes together. Just like I'll say to you, can you please remember that we need to buy a jar of honey? And an hour later, I'll ask you, what did I ask you to do? I forgot. And you say, you asked me to buy a jar. You said, please remember to buy a jar of honey. So you have remembered all the same phonemes. Even though the phonemes are gone, somehow your mind retained something that let you remember all of them, right? The same sentence, same phonemes. So there is remembrance of all the phonemes, actually. Even an hour later, even maybe a year later, you can remember the whole sentence with all its phonemes. Not just said something about a jar of something, but you can, if you've got a sharp memory, you can remember exactly everything I said. That means you can recollect the phonemes, every one of them, even after they're gone, somehow. Okay? So the phonemes are remembered again in an awareness that displays perception of all the phonemes together. Then they invariably make the various meanings known that comprise the statement. Various meanings, because you have meanings for each word. And then the words by grammar, syntax, combine together to give you the meaning of the sentence. Bodhisattvas don't like to think like that, but Panini thought like that. He taught us how to figure out what words mean and how to properly form them. He didn't care too much about how words combine to make a sentence. He gave us the karaka, prakaranam, but he didn't make that the focus of his grammar. The focus was the words. So, figure out the words, and then they'll combine by the mechanisms of syntax, they'll combine into the meaning of the sentence. Invariably. That means, please remember to buy a jar of honey. Everybody here will understand the same meaning of the sentence if you know English. You may react differently to it. One person might say, okay, I got to run right now and get a jar of honey. The other one might say, I'm not going to do it, so let somebody else do it. Your reaction may be different, but your understanding of what the sentence means will be the same. Everybody in the room, everybody who knows English. And if I say it again a year later, it'll still mean the same thing. It may be in a different context, and what you do about it may be different, but the meaning of the sentence is invariable. If you figure out what the words mean and you got them in the right order, then the meaning of the sentence is fixed. There's no Heisenberg uncertainty principle here. If the words are fixed and you understand the meanings, then invariably they're going to mean something in particular. The meaning of the sentence will be fixed by the meanings, by the words, their meaning and the order they're in. That's a Vedanta way of looking at it. According to Vedanta, this is the way that the sounds, the little sounds, the phonemes, the aksharas, help us make it possible for us to recognize the meaning of the sentence. The phonemes themselves have the power. They are the sentence. No need to introduce another energy called spota. Who agrees with that, and who prefers the Spotavad? Anybody prefer the Spotavad? Makes it more complicated. That's what the next paragraph says. Do I say that here? No, that's not here, but it will be said. Yeah, lagiyasi kalpana syat. Ato varna vadinam alpiyasi. Okay, thus those who propose the phoneme theory have less to presume than the proponents of spota who abandon what is apparent and presume what is not. So just what you just said, it's a simpler theory. Those who propose the phoneme theory have less to presume than the proponents of spota who abandon what is apparent. What's apparent is that the phonemes come together and make a word, and if you recognize the phonemes, there's an energy in there, in the phonemes, that lets you know the meaning of the word. even if the individual phonemes don't have any particular meaning, when they come together, they create your understanding of the word. That's what's apparent. And the Spotavadis say, no, you think it's like that. That's what it looks like. But actually, it's more complicated than that. There's another energy called Spota. So that's doing two things, abandoning what is apparent. What's apparent is that the Aksharas have the power. And you say, no, there's something else that has the power called Spota. So you're abandoning what is apparent and presuming what is not apparent. What's not apparent is the Spota. I've seen Aksharas, I've heard Aksharas, but I never saw or heard a Spota. Where's the Spota coming from? It's presuming something that's not apparent, not obvious. Okay, that makes the theory more complicated in two ways. Therefore, we prefer the simpler theory. Okay, then again, next sentence. Tata varnas cheme kramena grihyamana spotam vyanjayanti saspoto artam vyanakti gariyasi kalpana syaditi manyante. The Vedantists are of opinion, that to say that these phonemes perceived in sequence reveal the spota, and that the spota reveals the meaning is a heavier presumption. Why is it a heavier presumption? Because you have two steps instead of one. You got to put the spota in the middle. Phonemes reveal the spota, then the spota reveals the sentence, the meanings of the sentence. But that's two steps. If you can do it in one step, just let the phonemes reveal the meaning, it's simpler. This is more complicated, unnecessarily. Especially since the spota, it seems to us, to normal people, that this, you hear the sounds and then you understand. But they have to ignore the natural perception of most people and introduce something artificial, an extra energy called spota. Unnecessarily complicated. And I'll read the commentary short. Anyone who uses words knows that we understand them by recognizing their phonemes one after another. No? The Spotavadis, however, deny this obvious fact and replace it with a concept that represents nothing in ordinary experience. The Spotavadis presume further that what is eternal in the Vedas is not the individual letters and words, but the overall meaning. This eternal meaning, they say, is recollected every time the Vedas are recited. The Vedantists, however, accept that not only the meaning, but also the phonemes and the words of the Vedas eternally exist. If it was just the meanings, then why isn't it that in the next Kali Yuga, the Vedas, you know, appear in Ukrainian? Why not? Why do they have to appear in Sanskrit? Same ideas, but you can use different phonemes. If the phonemes are not eternal, why can't you say the same ideas in some different language and still be Vedas? No, the phonemes themselves are eternal. Okay, now, any discussion?
Is there an example of phonemes which are not eternal? In other words, are they limited by the number of letters in the Sanskrit alphabet, or?
Well, like I don't know, because the Sanskrit writers don't give much consideration to other languages, the Sanskrit linguists. So they do talk about Prakrit and, you know, a few other languages. So I'm not sure if there are a certain number of phonemes in Vedic Sanskrit. I think classical Sanskrit doesn't have any extra phonemes, but it's missing some of the Vedic phonemes, if I'm right. I don't think in the Sanskrit that we're familiar with, there are any extra phonemes that don't occur in Vedic Sanskrit. But there are many other languages that have phonemes that don't occur in Sanskrit. Phonemes are just According to the modern linguists, human voice can produce a lot of different sounds. And it's really a continuum. You can touch your tongue like this or touch it a tiny bit further back or squeeze your mouth around in a little bit different shape. You know, move your tongue down a little bit. And it's analog. It's not digital. You know, it's not discrete differences. It's a whole continuum. So there's theoretically infinitely different sounds you can produce. Although you have to be attuned to recognize very slight differences. So in each language, the knowers of a particular language are tuned in to recognize certain differences and to ignore others. And when what they recognize as a different sound in a particular language is called a phoneme. But actually the phoneme can be produced in slightly different ways and still be considered the same phoneme. Those are called allophones. Sounds that are slightly different, or even quite different, but they're recognized, they're thought to be the same sound. Like in English, I say pin. Pin. There's a H sound there, a strong one. But if I put the P at the same, what's supposed to be the same P in English, there's only one P. We don't have a voiced P and an unvoiced, aspirated P and unaspirated P in English. We only have one P, pa. But if I say lip, at the end of a word, there's almost no aspiration. Basically none. So we do have two different sounds, aspirated pa and unaspirated pa, in English. But in English speakers don't recognize the difference. For English speakers, they're the same sound, even though they're physically different. But they're one akshara. In Sanskrit, they're two different aksharas. So it's really a mental disposition of the language, of the speakers of the language, which sounds they recognize to be different and which ones they don't. So therefore, there are basically each language has a different set of phonemes. So you run into the problem, okay, the phonemes of Vedic Sanskrit are eternal, what about the phonemes of Swahili? Some of them don't occur in Sanskrit, or some of them are not really the same as the ones in Sanskrit. I don't know the answer to that question. I gave you the background, what the problem is. I don't know what the scholarly answer is.
The underpinning of this question is that if we say that, if we admit to the or accept the theory of Vedantists that everything hinges on the phonemes being eternal, then we'll have to admit that the Vedas are not possible to be translated into other languages and give the same spiritual experience, and they cannot lead people to other people of other languages to a meaningful spiritual realization.
Did you study the Bhagavad Gita originally and the Bhagavatam in the original Sanskrit, or do you read them in translation?
Given in translation. By Prabhupada? Exactly, that's my point.
How do you become a devotee?
That's exactly my point. That is not true.
Yeah.
And we don't subscribe to it. But in their theory, that everything hinges on those eternal phonemes, and in some words, in some languages, these phonemes are not present, and therefore we should accept, we should try to explain how the spiritual experience communicated.
The theory you're talking about is the theory that our school prescribes to. So it's our theory. We don't want to knock it down. It's the theory accepted by our acharyas. So we want to defend it.
The phonemes are eternal.
Yeah. Let me speculate. I'd say that when the original eternal phonemes of Sanskrit, let's say Vedic Sanskrit, are reflected in another language, there's a distortion of the reflection. Some of the phonemes come out different, and then there's other phonemes that aren't there in Sanskrit that are substituted for the original ones. There are substitutions, there are transformations and substitutions of those phonemes. You could say that the substituted and transformed forms are not eternal, but there's a link. The eternal sound and the eternal meaning of the Vedas can be conveyed through non-eternal sound in a non-eternal language. You can translate the Vedas, and if you actually know what the Vedas mean, you have realization, not just know what the words mean, but you realize by spiritual insight, by being given that insight, by your spiritual masters, and you know what the Vedas are saying, then you can convey it. Even in pig Latin, you can convey it what do they call it? Pidgin English, you know, which only has 100 words or something. You can manage somehow to convey the meaning if you've got spiritual insight. There is a way to translate. Exactly how it works, theoretically, I can't say. Some people have thought about it and said things about it. But I don't know if it can be completely explained how translation works, but it does work. You could make devotees on the basis of translation into another language, even an imperfect translation, even a bad translation can make devotees. If there is a potency of realization being expressed in it.
So maybe this is the spot of which they talk about the potency of realization. No, I'm just joking. I mean to say that if we do accept that the spiritual experience received from translated versions of the Vedas is the same in quality and
no, what there is,
level.
What there is that the meaning makes a difference, even if the way you say the way you express the meaning differs because you're in a different language. But if the same meaning is being conveyed even in a different language, that's not spota. Spota is saying that this is something, some power other than the power of the phonemes. Now, it's the power of the phonemes that reveals the meaning in Sanskrit, and then when you translate into Swahili, it's the power of the Swahili phonemes and the Swahili grammar and Swahili lexicon, words of the word meanings, that conveys the same meaning. It's the expert translator who can create an equivalent in the foreign language.
But that's my question. How?
But it's not spotavad. It's not spota because it's still the phonemes that are revealing the meaning. But an expert translator can make the same meaning come out of phonemes in a different language.
But this is a question. How can non-eternal phonemes in another language create or evoke eternal experience or convey?
Because you can express the eternal meaning in a non-eternal language. That's the job of a translator.
So how can a mere jiva, like I had to translate...
An empowered jiva.
I'm not empowered, but somehow I had to translate.
You have to be empowered to translate. To translate to Shastra, you have to be empowered. It's Krishna's magic. It's materially impossible. It's almost impossible to do any translation, even mundane material. And to translate the eternal Shastra into a barbarian language, a language of meat-eaters and barbarians, is a materially impossible thing to do, but Krishna empowers the devotee to do it.
What do you speak of languages? Sometimes people translate them into comics books, and they create devotees by them, or video, or some flash presentation on computer screen.
Yes.
And they convey the same. So the point I'm trying to lead to, and I just want to confirm with you, or disprove it, is that actually it's not even the aksharas themselves, but Krishna who endows the aksharas with a particular status or particular potency to relate to us the eternal existence that
it's Krishna.
Is the basis of
it's
our
Krishna behind the whole thing, but he's put his energy in the aksharas. We can say that.
So he can transfer the same energy into other aksharas if there is some particular sincere devotee who wants that to happen.
He'll give the devotee the intelligence to do it. He won't do it himself. He'll empower a devotee to do that. To express the same meaning in some other form, even an artificial form. You can translate Prabhupada's books into Esperanto. Can be done. Or you can make up a completely different language just for translating. Yes. It's an insane over-endeavor to do that, but it could be done.
Yes. And therefore, that's probably, which is the last sentence, probably that what Prabhupada means in the Krishna book when he says that eventually... it's a matter of whether Krishna, whether absolute truth is personal or not. Because if he's impersonal, then we're stuck with eternal aksharas. There is no other higher realm of spiritual revelation. But if he's a person, then he can change things and he can adjust things, so we can get the same spiritual experience by using other phonemes and words,
yes,
and even other ways of communication.
Not by mechanical or impersonal
not
means,
by
but by inspiration coming from Krishna
and service of the spiritual master.
Yes, well, that's where you get Krishna's inspiration from.
Krishna
service of the spiritual master.
Krishna Shakti Vinanahitara Pravartan.
Dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayanti te. Thank you. Yes.
These phonemes are involved only in the languages that humans speak, or what about the interaction with the computers, like the languages like C, C++, Java and all? They also contain lot of grammar involved and syntax and everything. So humans interact with the machines using phonemes ultimately.
Yes.
And that also in the whole theory, I can think of being involved in those interactions also.
The languages used for artificial intelligence, okay, the languages used to communicate with computers, it's human beings communicating with computers. Computers don't write their own programs. They don't make up programs to talk to each other. And human beings don't talk to one another in computer language. Some do, okay. But actually, the purpose of computer languages is for human beings to talk to computers. Not even, well, the other way around too. But there's a process of translation. Actually, a computer language is two languages. You know that. That, you know, there's always a process of translation. Either it's on the run, or there's a compilation. And it may go through more than two phases of translation. You know, your source code is translated into an object code, and then linked and translated into executed code. Now, what form is the source code in? Something that looks like your own language. It's words, phonemes and words of your human language. Mostly they use English. I don't think they have computer languages that use Russian words. I don't think so. They all use English words mostly, computer languages. There is such? They had, okay. But you know, it's sort of just, you know, it's sort of the standard around the world is to use English words for computer languages. It's words that we understand. It's an artificial, you could say a subset or an adaptation of our own human language that creates the first level, the source code. And then through one or more steps, it's translated into something the computer understands. But what does the computer understand? Zero and one. That's all. The computer only has two phonemes, zero and one. Binary code. I guess you could have a computer with three phases, but most computers nowadays are binary computers. And everything breaks down to zero and one. You know, computer, until you get it down to the 0-1 level, the computer doesn't know what to do with it. So it's translated into computer languages really just permutations of zeros and ones. And the processor takes those permutations and knows to recognize commands and do them, operations, and to recognize what are memory addresses and to fetch things from memory and put them in memory and perform operations at all. Is recognized on the basis of those zeros and ones in certain order. So it's really two languages, or more than two languages, levels of translation that are involved. Human language or some adaptation of human language, like a small artificial human language based on your own real language, that gets translated in the computer to something the computer understands, which are a very different kind of set of phonemes, only two phonemes. Does that make sense enough? Just like you could say animals have some sort of language, but not really. They have simple symbol system. You know, the cows may have 10 different ways of mooing, and they mean different things. You know, the cow goes like a certain way, and it means I'm home, and the other cow moos something a little bit different. It means welcome home, or their chapati's over here. I don't know if they have a symbol for that. There's just 10 different moves. But there's no grammar. It's a dictionary with 10 words in it. And no real grammar. You don't combine them. You don't make a complex sentence out of those 10 moves. And you don't have verbs and nouns. So it's not a real language. It's a very rudimentary symbol system that's used for communication, but we don't consider it a language. It's a primitive animal symbol communication system. Computer system is like that. Computers actually understand in a very, actually they don't understand at all. But they, you know, we make them act as if they understand based on a very simple symbol system that's hardwired in the processor to do certain things when certain patterns of zeros and ones come by. Yes.
I have two things. One is a comment and a question. Well, you see, when I came to India, I didn't understand the lettings, but then when I started to understand, oh, this is an English word that they've written in their own aksharas.
Yes.
So it seems like they're using also the same aksharas from Sanskrit. I mean, Hindi.
Slice. System of phonemes is very close to Sanskrit. So there are few extra phonemes in Hindi, and a few missing.
Yeah. So they take many words of English, and I can understand. Oh, petrol. Oh, Hindi.
And when you say petrol to a local, he knows what you mean.
Yeah.
Because they've adapted the word petrol into their own language. They know what it means because now it's a Hindi word too.
Yeah, but they with the same phonemes, they have different phonemes.
Yes, they borrowed this is tatsama. Yeah. Two different kinds of borrowed words. Tatsama, where the phonemes don't change, and tadbhava, where they change. Like if I say anka. What's the word first? Amshu. Oh, that's not a good example. Oh, you know, some Sanskrit words are borrowed into Hindi in the same exact form. Like, you can say mukha in Hindi. Well, mukha and munk. They're both words in Hindi. There is the original word, Sanskrit word mukha. It's recognizable in Hindi. It's also a Hindi word. But they have a Prakrit word, munk, that they use more often. Munk. Of course, that's a corruption of mukha. The munk form is called tatsama. It's the same idea, but the word's been mixed up a bit. It's been changed. You know, you've changed the ka into So some words are borrowed from English exactly as they are, and some are changed. If you say that you have a flat tire, in Hindi you call it a pincture. Not a puncture, but a pincture. And the hot water heater is called not a geyser, but a geezer. Yeah, so there's some changes. That's tatsama words, where you've changed it a bit.
And also there was once somebody gave me a piece of paper. It was like a joke, and in this piece of paper it was written, "It is amazing that when you read a sentence, the first and last letter, if the first and last letter are kept the same, but then all the other letters in the word are mixed up, still you understand the word." And all this text was written like that.
Well, that's because in your language, in any particular language, there's only certain combinations of letters that actually occur. You know, and so if you know two of the letters in the word, and the first ones you're going to recognize are the first and last ones, you can guess the other word letters because you don't have that many possibilities. That's how you do that in mobile phones too. You hit just one letter and it guesses what the whole word is. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. So you can guess, you can make a good guess just by seeing two letters what the whole word is, because it's not that many different possibilities of combinations. But it depends on the language. In some languages, there's so many possibilities you can't guess so easily.
But so these are just triggers of the remembrance of the proper combination.
Yeah, because when you're hearing, you're not hearing perfectly. 70, if you're hearing clearly, you might hear 80% of what somebody says. 80% of the actual phonemes come into your brain clearly. The other 80 don't, because the person's mumbling, or because you're not listening clearly, or there's noise, or you're not attentive. And still you recognize everything. You know, 70 or 80% is enough. If you only hear clearly 70 or 80% of the phonemes, you still know what it means. You still recognize the words. And that's what normally happens. Otherwise, people would have to speak a lot more clearly than they do. to be recognized, to be understood. But they can mumble a little bit, and there can be noise, and there can be inattention, and still the communication works. When you're dealing with a language you know well, when you're trying to learn a new language, then you have to really pay attention, because you're not familiar with it. This is, if you don't mind, we're off the topic, but go ahead. Yeah. Vishnukanta.
Actually, in one of our assignments during our graduation, we made up our own language called Cradle. We wrote the grammar for that and created our own phonemes. And of course, all this is from the end user's perspective. But ultimately, as you explained, from the computer side, it accepts only zeros and ones. So this whole language called Cradle was made in such a way that it follows the particular grammar structured for that. And accordingly, the words, all those things will be accepted as different things. So people who know the grammar can make up their own phonemes and subsequently their commands.
What was the purpose of it?
Purpose is to construct a compiler, our own compiler. So if we make our own language, we cannot use any other compiler. We have to make our own compiler in order to translate this program into different stages and ultimately to the ALP.
I'm sorry, you're making a computer language.
Yeah, computer language.
Oh, okay.
So in that case, anybody would be... So just by knowing the grammar, one can understand the phoneme and the overall meaning of the whatever the phonemes are combined in various permutations and combinations.
Yes.
So isn't that just by grammar one can understand the...
Oh, no, I don't understand that.
Any language, for that matter.
If you may know the grammar. Grammar is just two different ideas of grammar. One part of grammar is how the words change according to the use in the sentence. That's inflections. Same word, but you have to put different endings or different prefixes sometimes on the same word. Right? That's part of grammar. You've done a lot of study of that, of the different pratyayas you have to put on words. Some languages don't do that, but Sanskrit does that a lot. And then also, there's how the words relate to each other to make a sentence. One word is the verb, one word is the subject, like that. That you study in the Karaka Prakaranam. Those are the two basic components of grammar. But you may know grammar perfectly, but what if you don't know what the words mean? Panini doesn't teach you, basically, not much. He gives a few, says a few things, but he doesn't teach you what all the words mean. That's not the business of grammar. You need to learn that from a dictionary or some way. Someone has to tell you what the words mean. So it's not sufficient just to know the grammar. You got to know what the words mean, and you got to know how people actually use the language. You may know the grammar, and you may know what all the words mean, or a lot of the words. You may know 5,000 words, and you may know all the grammar. You've memorized it all. And then you go to speak to an actual person from that community, and he won't understand a word you're saying because you're not familiar with the usage. You make up sentences that nobody would ever say. You know, technically right, but nobody's talked like that for 500 years, and nobody ever talked like that. Even though it's theoretically correct, it's not the usage. So, and then they say something you don't understand because you don't know the usage. So you can't communicate unless you know not only the grammar, but the meanings of the words, and how they're actually used in real life. How actual uses of language nowadays, not 500 years ago, not 500 years in the future, but nowadays, how do people actually use the words? You got to know all three. That for a real language, computers, you can make them do what you want, but when you're dealing with real people, you have to know that much to be able to communicate with them. And when you make up your own language, you're actually making it up on the basis of the language you already know. The language that you know says that there's brown and there's red and there's yellow, three different colors, okay? It divides up the spectrum that way. But another language may have 8 different words for brown and 10 different words for yellow and no word for red. So you've divided up reality according to the language that you know. So when you create an artificial language, you're importing the division up, you know, how you divide up reality from your own language. It's actually not a new creation completely. It's just something you're changing your language into something artificial. But you're taking a lot of assumptions, a lot of ideas, a lot of concepts, especially concepts of how, what words are going to refer to what things. You know, is a tree and a bush two different things? Or do we just have one word in our language for tree and we call it big tree and little tree? One language will have two words and one language will have only one word. Eskimos have 30 different words for snow. But we don't. So you made up a language for your computer, but you made it based up on the language you're thinking in. Actually. Just like the grammarians are trying to make up a new grammar, they're all based on Panini. Vopadeve and everybody else's. They know Panini, that's what they're familiar with, and then they try to make up something different, but it's not completely different. It takes a lot of assumptions and a lot of ideas from Panini, and then they pretend to change it around. Yes?
Is it okay if we take a little bit extra time to cover a little bit more?
Oh, why don't we do more next time?
Okay.
We're so far off track, and to get back on track will be a little tough. Why don't we just stop? It's 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. We're almost through with this part of the Sarvasambhata, and then we can get back to the original text of the Sandarbhas. Oh, we're past the worst part. Okay? Thank you, O glorious Srila Prabhupada, Sri Tattva Sandarbha Ki Jai.